the usual habit of eating too much, drinking 5 varieties of wine, and saying nothing, yet talking for 3 long hours. He feared he was a disappointment to his wealthier junior men, who threw lavish parties at their own expense. "They cannot understand me," he wrote, "and I am sorry for them." He wished Sandburg all speed in completing his book on Lincoln, then lamented, "My half-completed old South will probably be buried with me." He closed the letter ruefully. "Once more, greetings from Berlin." At least his health was good, though he had his usual bouts of hay fever, indigestion, and bowel upsets. But as if foreshadowing what was to come, his doctor in Chicago, Wilbur E. Post, with an office appropriately enough in the People's Gas Building, sent Dodd a memorandum that he had written after his last thorough examination a decade earlier, for Dodd to use as a baseline against which to compare the results of future examinations. "Dodd had a history of migraines," Post wrote, "with attacks of headaches, dizziness, fatigue, low spirits, and irritability of intestinal tract, the latter condition being best treated by physical exercise in the open air and freedom from nervous strain and fatigue. His blood pressure was excellent, 100 systolic, 60 diastolic, more what one would expect from an athlete than from a man in late middle age. The outstanding clinical feature has been that Mr. Dodd's health has been good when he has had the opportunity to get plenty of open-air exercise and a comparatively bland, non-irritating diet without too much meat." In a letter appended to the report, Dr. Post wrote, "I trust that you will have no occasion to use it, but it might be helpful in case you do." That Friday evening, a special train, a Sonderzug, made its way from Berlin through the night landscape toward Nuremberg. The train carried the ambassadors of an array of minor nations, among them the ministers to Haiti, Siam, and Persia. It also carried protocol officers, stenographers, a doctor, and a cadre of armed stormtroopers. This was the train that was to have carried Dodd and the ambassadors of France, Spain, and Britain. Originally, the Germans had planned on 14 rail cars, but as the regrets came in, they scaled back to 9. Hitler was already in Nuremberg. He had arrived the night before for a welcome ceremony, his every moment choreographed right down to the gift presented to him by the city's mayor, a famous print by Albrecht Dürer entitled Night, Death, and the Devil. Chapter 13. My Dark Secret. Martha delighted in the very entertainments that so wore on her father. As the daughter of the American ambassador, she possessed instant cachet, and in short order found herself sought after by men of all ranks, ages, and nationalities. Her divorce from her banker husband, Bassett, was still pending, but all that remained were the legal formalities. She considered herself free to behave as she wished, and to disclose or not disclose the legal reality of her marriage. She found secrecy a useful and engaging tool. Outwardly she looked the part of a young American virgin, but she knew sex and liked it, and especially liked the effect when a man learned the truth. "I suppose I practiced a great deception on the diplomatic corps by not indicating that I was a married woman at that time," she wrote, "but I must admit I rather enjoyed being treated like a maiden of 18, knowing all the while my dark secret." She had ample opportunity to meet new men. The house on Tiergartenstrasse was always full of students, German officials, embassy secretaries, correspondents, and men from the Reichswehr, the SA, and the SS. The Reichswehr officers carried themselves with aristocratic elan, and confessed to her their secret hopes for a restoration of the German monarchy. She found them extremely pleasant, handsome, courteous, and uninteresting. She caught the attention of Ernst Udet, a flying ace from the Great War, who in the years since had become famous throughout Germany as an aerial adventurer, explorer, and stunt pilot. She went falcon hunting with Udet's fellow ace Göring at his vast estate, Karrenhall, named for his dead Swedish wife. Martha had a brief affair with Putzi Hanfstengel, or so his son Egon later claimed. She was frankly sexual and put the house to good use, taking full advantage of her parents' habit of going to bed early. Eventually, she would have an affair with Thomas Wolfe when the writer visited Berlin. Wolfe would tell a friend later that she was like a butterfly hovering around my penis. One of her French lovers was Armand Berard, third secretary of the French embassy, 6.5 feet tall, and incredibly handsome, Martha recalled. Before Berard asked her out on their first date, he asked Ambassador Dodd for permission, an act that Martha found both charming and amusing. She did not tell him of her marriage, and as a consequence, much to her secret delight, he treated her at first as a sexual ingenue. She knew that she possessed great power over him, and that even some casual act or comment could drive him to despair. In their estranged periods, she would see other men, and make sure he knew it. "You are the only person on earth who can break me," he wrote at one point. "But how well you know it, and how you seem to rejoice in doing so." He begged her not to be so hard. "I can't stand it," he wrote. "If you realized how unhappy I am, you would probably pity me." For one suitor, Max Delbruch, a young biophysicist, the recollection of her skill at manipulation remained fresh even 4 decades later. He was slender and had a cleanly sculpted chin and masses of dark, neatly combed hair, for a look that evoked a young Gregory Peck. He was destined for great things, including a Nobel Prize that would be awarded in 1969. In a late-life exchange of letters, Martha and Delbruch reminisced about their time together in Berlin. She recalled their innocence as they sat together in one of the reception rooms, and wondered if he did as well. "Of course I remember the green damask room off the dining room in the Tiergartenstrasse," he wrote. But his recollection diverged a bit from hers. "We did not only sit there modestly." With a bit of dusty pique, he reminded her of one rendezvous at the Romanisches Café. "You came terribly late, and then yawned away and explained that you did that because you felt relaxed in my company, and that it was a compliment to me." With no small degree of irony, he added, "I became quite enthusiastic about this idea, after first getting upset, and have been yawning at my friends ever since." Martha's parents gave her full independence, with no restrictions on her comings or goings. It was not uncommon for her to stay out until early in the morning with all manner of escorts, yet family correspondence is surprisingly free of censorious comment. Others noticed, however, and disapproved, among them Consul General George Messersmith, who communicated his distaste to the State Department, thereby adding fuel to the quietly growing campaign against Dodd. Messersmith knew of Martha's affair with Udit, the flying ace, and believed she had been involved in romantic affairs with other ranking Nazis, including Hanfstengel. In a personal and confidential letter to J. Pierpont Moffat, the Western European Affairs Chief, Messersmith wrote that these affairs had become grist for gossip. He assessed them as mostly harmless, except in the case of Hanfstengel. He feared that Martha's relationship with Hanfstengel and her seeming lack of discretion caused diplomats and other informants to be more reticent about what they told Dodd, fearing that their confidences would make their way back to Hanfstengel. "I often felt like saying something to the ambassador about it," Messersmith told Moffat. "But as it was rather a delicate matter, I confined myself to making it clear as to what kind of a person Hanfstengel really is." Messersmith's view of Martha's behavior hardened over time. In an unpublished memoir, he wrote that she had behaved so badly in so many ways, especially in view of the position held by her father. The Dodd's butler, Fritz, framed his own criticism succinctly. "That was not a house, but a house of ill repute." Martha's love life took a dark turn when she was introduced to Rudolf Diels, the young chief of the Gestapo. He moved with ease and confidence, Yet, unlike Putzi Hanfstengel, who invaded a room, he entered unobtrusively, seeping in like a malevolent fog. His arrival at a party, she wrote, created a nervousness and tension that no other man possibly could, even when people did not know his identity. What most drew her attention was the tortured landscape of his face, which she described as the most sinister, scar-torn face I have ever seen. One long scar in the shape of a shallow V marked his right cheek. Others arced below his mouth and across his chin. An especially deep scar formed a crescent at the bottom of his left cheek. His overall appearance was striking, that of a damaged Ray Milland, a cruel, broken beauty, as Martha put it. His was the opposite of the bland handsomeness of the young Reichswehr officers, and she was drawn to him immediately. His lovely lips, his jet-black, luxuriant hair, and his penetrating eyes. She was hardly alone in feeling this attraction. Diels was said to have great charm and to be sexually talented and experienced. As a student, he had gained a reputation as a drinker and philanderer, according to Hans Bernd Gisevius, a Gestapo man who had been a student at the same university. Involved affairs with women were a regular thing with him, Gisevius wrote in a memoir. Men also acknowledged Diels's charm and manner. When Kurt Ludeck, an early associate of Hitler's, found himself under arrest and summoned to Diels's office, he found the Gestapo chief unexpectedly cordial. I felt at ease with this tall, slender, and polished young man, and found his consideration instantly comforting, Ludeck wrote. It was an occasion when good manners were doubly welcome. He noted, I went back to my cell feeling I'd rather be shot by a gentleman than drubbed by a churl. Nonetheless, Ludeck ultimately wound up imprisoned, under protective custody, at a concentration camp in Brandenburg an der Havel. What Martha also found compelling about Diels was the fact that everyone else was afraid of him. He was often referred to as the Prince of Darkness, and as Martha learned, he did not mind at all. He took a vicious joy in his Mephistophelian manners and always wanted to create a hush by his melodramatic entrance. Diels, early on, had allied himself closely with Göring, and when Hitler became Chancellor, Göring, as the new Prussian Minister of the Interior, rewarded Diels's loyalty by making him head of the newly created Gestapo, despite the fact that Diels was not a member of the Nazi Party. Göring installed the agency in an old art school at Prince Albrechtstrasse 8, roughly 2 blocks from the U.S. consulate on Bellevue Strasse. By the time of the Dodds' arrival in Berlin, the Gestapo had become a terrifying presence, though it was hardly the all-knowing, all-seeing entity that people imagined it to be. Its roster of employees was remarkably small, according to historian Robert Gallately. He cites the example of the agency's Dusseldorf branch, one of the few for which detailed records survive. It had 291 employees responsible for a territory encompassing 4 million people. Its agents, or specialists, were not the sociopaths of popular depiction Gallately found. Most of them were neither crazed, demented, nor superhuman, but terribly ordinary. The Gestapo enhanced its dark image by keeping its operations and its sources of information secret. Out of the blue, people received postcards, requesting that they appear for questioning. These were uniquely terrifying. Despite their prosaic form, such summonses could not be discarded or ignored. They put citizens in the position of having to turn themselves in at that most terrifying of buildings, to respond to charges of offenses about which they likely had no inkling, with the potential, often imagined, but in many cases quite real, that by day's end they would find themselves in a concentration camp under protective custody. It was this accumulation of unknowns that made the Gestapo so fearsome. One can evade a danger that one recognizes, wrote historian Friedrich Zipfel, but a police working in the dark becomes uncanny. Nowhere does one feel safe from it. While not omnipresent, it could appear, search, arrest, The worried citizen no longer knows whom he ought to trust. Yet under Diels, the Gestapo played a complex role. In the weeks following Hitler's appointment as Chancellor, Diels's Gestapo acted as a curb against a wave of violence by the SA, during which stormtroopers dragged thousands of victims to their makeshift prisons. Diels led raids to close them, and found prisoners in appalling conditions, beaten and garishly bruised, limbs broken, near starvation, like a mass of inanimate clay, he wrote. Absurd puppets with lifeless eyes burning with fever, their bodies sagging. Martha's father liked Diels. To his surprise, he found the Gestapo chief to be a helpful intermediary for extracting foreign nationals and others from concentration camps and for exerting pressure on police authorities outside Berlin to find and punish the SA men responsible for attacks against Americans. Diels was no saint, however. During his tenure as chief, thousands of men and women were arrested, many tortured, some murdered. On Diels's watch, for example, a German communist named Ernst Thälmann was imprisoned and interrogated at Gestapo headquarters. Thälmann left a vivid account. They ordered me to take off my pants, and then two men grabbed me by the back of the neck and placed me across a footstool. A uniformed Gestapo officer with a whip of hippopotamus hide in his hand then beat my buttocks with measured strokes. Driven wild with pain, I repeatedly screamed at the top of my voice. In Diels's view, violence and terror were valuable tools for the preservation of political power. During a gathering of foreign correspondents at Putzi Hanfstengel's home, Diels told the reporters, "The value of the SA and the SS, seen from my viewpoint of Inspector General, responsible for the suppression of subversive tendencies and activities, lies in the fact that they spread terror. That is a wholesome thing." Martha and Diels took walks together in the Tiergarten, which was fast becoming recognized as the one place in central Berlin where a person could feel at ease. Martha especially loved strolling through the park in autumn, amid what she termed the golden death of the Tiergarten. They went to movies and nightclubs and drove for hours through the countryside. That they became lovers seems likely, despite the fact that both were married, Martha in technical terms only, Diels in name only, given his penchant for adultery. Martha loved being known as the woman who slept with the devil, and that she did sleep with him seems beyond doubt. Though it is equally likely that Dodd, like naive fathers everywhere and in every time, had no idea. Messerschmitt suspected it, and so did Raymond Geist, his second in command. Geist complained to Wilbur Carr, head of consular services in Washington, that Martha was a most indiscreet young lady who had been in the habit of constantly going about at night with the head of the Nazi secret police, a married man. Geist himself had heard her call Diels in public a variety of affectionate names, among them, Deary. The more Martha came to know Diels, the more she saw that he, too, was afraid. He felt he was constantly facing the muzzle of a gun, she wrote. He was most at ease during their drives, when no one could overhear their conversations or monitor their behavior. They would stop and walk through forests and have coffee in remote, little-known cafes. He told her stories of how everyone in the Nazi hierarchy distrusted everyone else, how Goering and Goebbels loathed each other and spied on each other, how both spied on Diels, and how Diels and his men spied on them in turn. It was through Diels that she began, for the first time, to temper her idealistic view of the Nazi revolution. "There began to appear before my romantic eyes a vast and complicated network of espionage, terror, sadism, and hate, from which no one, official or private, could escape. Not even Diels, as events soon would demonstrate." Chapter 14. The Death of Boris. There was still another lover in Martha's life, the most important of all, a doomed Russian, who would shape the rest of her life. She first caught a glimpse of him in mid-September 1933 at one of the many parties Sigrid Schultz held at her apartment, where she lived with her mother and her two dogs. Schultz typically served sandwiches, baked beans, and sausages prepared by her mother, and provided a lot of beer, wine, and liquor, which tended to cause even Nazi guests to shed doctrine in favor of fun and gossip. In the midst of a conversation, Martha happened to glance across the room and saw a tall, good-looking man at the center of a group of correspondents. He was not handsome in a conventional sense, but very attractive. Maybe 30, short blonde brown hair, strikingly luminous eyes, and an easy, fluid manner. He moved his hands as he spoke, and Martha saw that he had long and supple fingers. He had an unusual mouth and upper lip, recalled one of Martha's friends, Agnes Knickerbocker, wife of correspondent H.R. Nick Knickerbocker. I can't describe it other than to say that it could go from sternness to laughter in an exploding split second. As Martha watched him, he turned and looked at her. She held his gaze a few moments, then looked away and became involved in other conversations. In a later unpublished account, she recalled minute details of this moment, and others to follow. He turned away as well, but when the morning came and the night distilled to its essential elements, this meeting of glances was the thing that both remembered. Several weeks later, they encountered each other again. Nick and his wife invited Martha and a few other friends to join them for a night of drinks and dancing at Ciro's, a popular nightclub that employed black jazz musicians, a twofold act of defiance, given the Nazi Party's obsession with racial purity and its condemnation of jazz, in party jargon, nigger Jew jazz, as degenerate music. Nick introduced Martha to the tall man she had seen at Sigrid Schultz's party. His name, she now learned, was Boris Vinogradov. A few moments later, Boris appeared before her table, smiling and self-conscious. "Gnadiges Fräulein," he began, offering the customary German greeting meaning, "Dear young lady." He asked her to dance. She was struck immediately by the beauty of his voice, which she described as falling somewhere between baritone and tenor. "Mellifluous," she wrote. It moved her, struck my heart, and for a moment left me without words or breath. He held out a hand to guide her from the crowded table. She quickly learned that his natural grace had limits. He walked her around the dance floor, stepping on my toes, bumping into people, his left arm stuck out stiffly, turning his head from side to side, trying to avoid further collisions. He told her, "I don't know how to dance." It was such an obvious fact that Martha burst out laughing. Boris laughed, too. She liked his smile and his overall aura of gentleness. A few moments later, he said to her, "I am with the Soviet embassy. Haben Sie Angst?" She laughed again. "Of course not. Why should I be afraid?" "Of what?" "Correct," he said. "You're a private person, and with you I am, too." He held her closer. He was slender and broad-shouldered and had eyes she deemed gorgeous, blue-green flecked with gold. He had irregular teeth that somehow enhanced his smile. He was quick to laugh. "I have seen you several times before," he said. The last occasion, he reminded her, had been at Schultz's home. "Erinnern Sie sich? Do you remember?" Contrarian by nature, Martha did not want to seem too easy a mark. She kept her voice non-committal, but did concede the fact. "Yes," she said. "I remember." They danced a while longer. When he returned her to the Knickerbocker's table, he leaned close and asked, "Ich möchte Sie sehr wiedersehen. Darf ich Sie anrufen?" The meaning was clear to Martha, despite her limited German. Boris was asking if he could see her again. She told Boris, "Yes, you may call." Martha danced with others. At one point she looked back toward her table and spotted the Knickerbockers with Boris seated beside them. Boris watched her. "Incredible as it sounds," she wrote, "I had the sensation after he left that the air around me was more luminous and vibrant." Several days later, Boris did call. He drove to the Dodds' house, introduced himself to Fritz, the butler, then went charging up the stairs to the main floor carrying a bouquet of autumn flowers and a disc for a record player. He did not kiss her hand, a good thing, for that particular German ritual always annoyed her. After a brief preamble, he held out the record. "You don't know Russian music, do you, Gnadiges Fräulein? Have you ever heard The Death of Boris by Mussorgsky?" He added, "I hope it's not my death I'm going to play for you." He laughed. She did not. It struck her even then as a portent of something dark to come. They listened to the music. The death scene from Modest Mussorgsky's opera Boris Godunov, sung by the famous Russian bass Fyodor Shalyapin. And then Martha gave Boris a tour of the house, finishing in the library. At one end was her father's desk, immense and dark, its drawers always locked. The late autumn sun broke through the high stained glass window in pleats of many-hued light. She led him to her favorite couch. Boris was delighted. "This is our corner, Gnadiges Fräulein," he exclaimed. "Better than all the others." Martha sat on the couch. Boris pulled over a chair. She rang for Fritz and asked him to bring beer and a casual fare of pretzels, sliced carrots and cucumbers, and hot cheese sticks, foods she usually ordered when she entertained unofficial visitors. Fritz brought the food, his step very quiet, almost as if he were attempting to listen in. Boris guessed correctly that Fritz, too, had Slavic roots. The two men traded pleasantries. Taking a cue from Boris's easy manner, Fritz quipped, "Did you communists really burn the Reichstag?" Boris gave him an arch smile and winked. "Of course we did," he said. "You and I together. Don't you recall the night we were at Göring's and were shown the secret passageway to the Reichstag?" This was an allusion to a widely believed theory that a team of Nazi incendiaries had secretly made their way from Göring's palace to the Reichstag via an underground tunnel between the two buildings. Such a tunnel did, in fact, exist. All three laughed. This mock complicity in the Reichstag fire would remain a joke between Boris and Fritz, repeated often in varying forms to the great delight of Martha's father, even though Fritz, Martha believed, was almost surely an agent of the secret police. Fritz returned with vodka. Boris poured himself a large drink and quickly downed it. Martha settled back in the couch. This time Boris sat beside her. He drank a second vodka, but showed no obvious sign of its effect. "From the first moment I saw you," he began. He hesitated, then said, "Can it be, I wonder?" She understood what he was trying to say, and in fact she too felt a powerful instant attraction, but she was not inclined to concede it this early in the game. She looked at him, blank. He grew serious. He launched into a lengthy interrogation. What did she do in Chicago? What were her parents like? What did she want to do in the future? The exchange had more in common with a newspaper interview than a first-date conversation. Martha found it vexing, but answered with patience. For all she knew, this was how all Soviet men behaved. "I had never before met a real communist, or a Russian, for that matter," she wrote. "So I imagine this must be their way of knowing someone." As the conversation wore on, both consulted pocket dictionaries. Boris knew some English, but not much, and conversed mainly in German. Martha knew no Russian, so deployed a mix of German and English. Though it took a good deal of effort, she told Boris that her parents were both offspring of old southern landowning families, each as well-ancestored as the other, and almost pure British. Scotch-Irish, English, and Welsh. Boris laughed. "That's not so pure, is it?" With an unconscious note of pride in her voice, she added that both families had once owned slaves, mothers about 12 or so, fathers 5 or 6. Boris went quiet. His expression shifted abruptly to one of sorrow. "Martha," he said, "surely you are not proud that your ancestors owned the lives of other human beings." He took her hands and looked at her. Until this moment, the fact that her parents' ancestors had owned slaves had always seemed merely an interesting element of their personal history that testified to their deep roots in America. Now, suddenly, she saw it for what it was. A sad chapter to be regretted. "I didn't mean to boast," she said. "I suppose it sounded like that to you." She apologized and immediately hated herself for it. She was, she conceded, a combative girl. "But we do have a long tradition in America," she told him. "We are not newcomers." Boris found her defensiveness hilarious and laughed with unrestrained delight. In the next instant, he adopted a look and tone that she recalled as being solemn in the extreme. "Congratulations, my noble, gracious little Martha. I too am also of ancient lineage, even older than yours. I am a direct descendant of Neanderthal man. And pure? Yes, pure human." They collapsed against each other with laughter. They became regular companions, though they tried to keep their emerging relationship as discreet as possible. The United States had not yet recognized the Soviet Union, and would not do so until November 16, 1933. To have the daughter of the American ambassador openly consorting with a first secretary of the Soviet embassy at official functions would have constituted a breach of protocol that would have put both her father and Boris at risk of criticism from inside and outside their respective governments. She and Boris left diplomatic receptions early, then met for secret meals at such fine restaurants as Horchers, Pelzer, Habel, and Kempinski. To cut costs a bit, Boris also cultivated the chefs of small, inexpensive restaurants and instructed them on how to prepare foods he liked. After dinner, he and Martha would go dancing at Ciro's or at the club on the roof of the Eden Hotel, or to political cabarets such as the Cabaret der Komiker. Some nights, Martha and Boris would join the correspondents gathered at Die Taverne, where Boris was always welcomed. The reporters liked him. The now-exiled Edgar Maurer had found Boris a refreshing change from other officials in the Soviet embassy. Boris, he recalled, spoke his mind, without slavish adherence to party doctrine, and seemed totally unintimidated by the kind of censorship which seemed to silence other members of the embassy. Like Martha's other suitors, Boris sought to escape Nazi intrusion by taking her on long drives into the countryside. He drove a Ford convertible, which he loved dearly. Agnes Knickerbocker recalled that he made some ceremony of putting on his fine leather gloves before taking the wheel. "He was an unswerving communist," she wrote, "but he liked the so-called good things in life." He almost always kept the top down, closing it only on the coldest nights. As his relationship with Martha deepened, he insisted on placing his arm around her as he drove. He seemed to need her touch at all times. He would place her hand on his knee or insert her fingers into his glove. On occasion, they took these drives late at night, sometimes staying out till dawn, Martha wrote, to welcome the rising sun in the black-green forests spangled with autumn gold. Though his English was limited, he learned and adored the word darling and used it every chance he got. He also deployed Russian endearments, which he refused to translate, claiming that to do so would diminish their beauty. In German, he called her "my little girl," or "my sweet child," or "my little one." She mused that he did so partly because of her height, partly because of his overall perception of her character and maturity. "He once said I had a naivete and idealism he could not easily understand," she wrote. She sensed that he found her too flighty to even attempt to indoctrinate her in the tenets of communism. "This was a period," she acknowledged, "when I must have appeared a most naive and stubborn young American, a vexation to all sensible people I knew." She found that Boris also took the world lightly, at least outwardly, At 31, she wrote, Boris had a childlike gaiety and faith, a madcap humor and charm not often found in mature men. Now and then, however, reality intruded on what Martha called their personal dream world of dinners and concerts, theaters and joyous festivities. She sensed in him a seam of tension. He was especially dismayed to see how readily the world accepted Hitler's protestations of peace, even as he so obviously girded the country for war. The Soviet Union seemed a likely target. Another source of stress was his own embassy's disapproval of his relationship with Martha. His superiors issued a reprimand. He ignored it. Martha, meanwhile, experienced pressure of a less official variety. Her father liked Boris, she thought, but he was often reticent in Boris's presence, even antagonistic at times. She attributed this mainly to his fear that she and Boris might get married. "My friends and family are disturbed about us," she told Boris. "What can come of it? Only complications. Some joy now and then perhaps long despair." For one of their September dates, Boris and Martha packed a picnic lunch and drove into the countryside. They found a private glade where they spread their blanket. The air was suffused with the scent of freshly cut grass. As Boris lay on the blanket, smiling at the sky, Martha plucked a length of wild mint and used it to tickle his face. He saved it, as she later discovered. He was a romantic, a collector of treasures. Even this early in their relationship, he was deeply smitten, and as it happens, closely watched. Martha appeared at this point to have no knowledge of what many correspondents suspected, that Boris was no mere first secretary of the embassy, but rather an operative for Soviet intelligence, the NKVD, precursor to the KGB. Chapter 15. The Jewish Problem. As ambassador, Dodd's main point of contact in the German government was Foreign Minister Neurath. Spurred by the Kaltenborn incident, Dodd arranged to meet with Neurath on Thursday morning, September 14, 1933, to make a formal protest against not just that episode, but also the many other attacks on Americans and the regime's apparent unwillingness to bring the perpetrators to justice. Their conversation took place in Neurath's office in the Foreign Ministry on Wilhelmstrasse. It began amiably enough with a discussion of economic matters, but the atmosphere quickly grew tense as Dodd broached the subject of SA brutalities and reviewed for Neurath half a dozen incidents. The most recent had occurred on August 31st in Berlin, the Samuel Bossard incident, in which Bossard was assaulted by members of the Hitler Youth after failing to offer the Hitler salute. A week earlier, another American, Harold Dahlquist, had been struck by a stormtrooper for failing to stop to watch an SA parade. Overall, the frequency of such attacks had decreased, as compared with the preceding spring, but incidents continued to occur at a steady rate of one or two a month. Dodd warned Neurath that press accounts of these attacks had caused real damage to Germany's reputation in America, and noted that this happened despite his own efforts to mute negative coverage by American correspondents. "I may say to you that the embassy has endeavored successfully on several occasions to prevent unimportant events from being reported, and also warned reporters from exaggerating their stories," he told Neurath. He revealed now that on one occasion his own car had been stopped and searched, apparently by an SA officer, but that he had kept the incident from being publicized to prevent widespread discussions which, as you know, would have become inevitable. Neurath thanked him and said he was aware of Dodd's efforts to temper press coverage of stormtrooper violence, including the incident that Martha and Bill Jr. had witnessed in Nuremberg. He professed to be very grateful. Dodd turned to the Kaltenborn episode. He told Neurath that the reaction in the United States could have been far worse if Kaltenborn himself had been inclined to publicize it. He was generous enough, however, to ask us not to allow any report of the episode to get out, and both Mr. Messersmith and I urged the American press not to mention this story, Dodd said. It did, however, get out, and did Germany incalculable injury. Neurath, though renowned for his lack of public effect, grew visibly perturbed, a novelty worth recording, as Dodd did in a strictly confidential memorandum he composed later that day. Neurath claimed to know Kaltenborn personally and condemned the attack as brutal and without justification. Dodd watched him. Neurath seemed sincere, but lately the foreign minister had been displaying a penchant for agreeing and then doing nothing. Dodd warned that if the attacks continued and if the assailants still evaded punishment, the United States might indeed be forced to publish a statement which would greatly damage the rating of Germany all over the world. Neurath's complexion turned a deeper red. Dodd continued, as if lecturing a wayward student. I cannot see how your officials can allow such behavior, or how they fail to see that it is one of the most serious things affecting our relations. Neurath claimed that during the preceding week he had raised the issue directly with Goering and Hitler. Both, he said, had assured him that they would use their influence to prevent further attacks. Neurath vowed to do likewise. Dodd pressed on, now venturing into even more charged territory. The Jewish problem, as Dodd and Neurath both termed it. Neurath asked Dodd whether the United States did not have a Jewish problem of its own. You know, of course, Dodd said, that we have had difficulty now and then in the United States with Jews who had gotten too much of a hold on certain departments of intellectual and business life. He added that some of his peers in Washington had told him confidentially that they appreciated the difficulties of the Germans in this respect, but that they did not for a moment agree with the method of solving the problem, which so often ran into utter ruthlessness. Dodd described his encounter with Fritz Haber, the chemist. Yes, Neurath said. I know Haber and recognize him as one of the greatest chemists in all Europe. Neurath agreed that Germany's treatment of Jews was wrong-headed and said his ministry was urging a more humane approach. He claimed to see signs of change. Just that week, he said, he had gone to the races at Baden-Baden, and three prominent Jews had sat with him on the platform along with other government officials, and there were no unfriendly expressions? Dodd said, You cannot expect world opinion of your conduct to moderate so long as eminent leaders like Hitler and Goebbels announce from platforms, as in Nuremberg, that all Jews must be wiped off the earth. Dodd rose to leave. He turned to Neurath. Shall we have a war? Again Neurath flushed. Never. At the door, Dodd said, You must realize that Germany would be ruined by another war. Dodd left the building, a little concerned that I had been so frank and critical. The very next day, the American consul in Stuttgart, Germany, sent a strictly confidential communique to Berlin in which he reported that the Mauser Company, in his jurisdiction, had sharply increased its production of arms. The consul wrote, No doubt can be entertained any longer that large-scale preparation for a renewal of aggression against other countries is being planned in Germany. Soon afterward, the same consul reported that German police had begun close surveillance of highways, routinely stopping travelers and subjecting them, their cars, and their baggage to detailed search. On one notorious occasion, the government ordered a nationwide halt of all traffic between noon and 12:40, so that squads of police could search all trains, trucks, and cars then in transit. The official explanation, quoted by German newspapers, was that the police were hunting for weapons, foreign propaganda, and evidence of communist resistance. Cynical Berliners embraced a different theory than making the rounds. That what the police really hoped to find and confiscate were copies of Swiss and Austrian newspapers carrying allegations that Hitler himself might have Jewish ancestry. Chapter 16 A Secret Request The attacks against Americans, his protests, the unpredictability of Hitler and his deputies, and the need to tread with so much delicacy in the face of official behavior that anywhere else might draw time in prison, all of it wore Dodd down. He was plagued by headaches and stomach troubles. In a letter to a friend, he described his ambassadorship as this disagreeable and difficult business. On top of it all came the quotidian troubles that even ambassadors had to cope with. In mid-September, the Dodds became aware of a good deal of noise coming from the fourth floor of their house on Tiergartenstrasse, which supposedly was occupied only by Panofsky and his mother. With no advance notice to Dodd, a team of carpenters arrived, and, starting at 7 o'clock each day, began hammering and sawing and otherwise raising a clamor, and continued doing so for 2 weeks. On September 18th, Panofsky wrote a brief note to Dodd. "Herewith I am informing you that at the beginning of the coming month, my wife and my children will return from their stay in the countryside back to Berlin. I am convinced that the comfort of Your Excellency and of Mrs. Dodd will not be impaired, as it is my aspiration to make your stay in my house as comfortable as possible." Panofsky moved his wife and children into the fourth floor, along with several servants. Dodd was shocked. He composed a letter to Panofsky, which he then edited heavily, crossing out and modifying every other line, clearly aware that this was more than a routine landlord-tenant matter. Panofsky was bringing his family back to Berlin because Dodd's presence ensured their safety. Dodd's first draft hinted that he might now have to move his own family and chided Panofsky for not having disclosed his plans in July. "Had he done so," Dodd wrote, "we should not have been in such an embarrassing position." Dodd's final draft was softer. "We are very happy indeed to hear that you are reunited with your family," he wrote in German. "Our only concern would be that your children won't be able to use their own home as freely as they would like. We bought our house in Chicago so that our children could experience the advantages of the outdoors. It would sadden me to have the feeling that we might hinder this entitled freedom and bodily movement of your children. If we had known about your plans in July, we would not have been in this tight spot right now." The Dodds, like abused tenants everywhere, resolved at first to be patient and to hope that the new din of children and servants would subside. It did not. The clatter of comings and goings and the chance appearances of small children caused awkward moments, especially when the Dodds entertained diplomats and senior Reich officials, the latter already disposed to belittle Dodd's frugal habits, his plain suits, the walks to work, the old Chevrolet, and now the unexpected arrival of an entire household of Jews. There was too much noise and disturbance, especially since the duties of my office required frequent entertainments, Dodd wrote in a memorandum. "I think anyone would have said it was an act of bad faith." Dodd consulted a lawyer. His landlord troubles and the mounting demands of his post made it increasingly difficult for Dodd to find time to work on his old South. He was able to write only for brief intervals in the evening and on weekends. He struggled to acquire books and documents that would have been simple to locate in America. The thing that weighed on him most, however, was the irrationality of the world in which he now found himself. To some extent, he was a prisoner of his own training. As a historian, he had come to view the world as the product of historical forces and the decisions of more or less rational people, and he expected the men around him to behave in a civil and coherent manner. But Hitler's government was neither civil nor coherent, and the nation lurched from one inexplicable moment to another. Even the language used by Hitler and party officials was weirdly inverted. The term fanatical became a positive trait. Suddenly it connoted what philologist Victor Klemperer, a Jewish resident of Berlin, described as a happy mix of courage and fervent devotion. Nazi-controlled newspapers reported an endless succession of fanatical vows and fanatical declarations and fanatical beliefs, all good things. Göring was described as a fanatical animal lover. Fanatischer Tierfreund. Certain very old words were coming into darkly robust modern use, Klemperer found. Übermensch, Superman, Untermensch, subhuman, meaning Jew. Wholly new words were emerging as well, among them Strafexpedition, punitive expedition. The term stormtroopers applied to their forays into Jewish and communist neighborhoods. Klemperer detected a certain hysteria of language in the new flood of decrees, alarms, and intimidation, this perpetual threatening with the death penalty, and in strange, inexplicable episodes of paranoid excess, like the recent nationwide search. In all this, Klemperer saw a deliberate effort to generate a kind of daily suspense, copied from American cinema and thrillers, that helped keep people in line. He also gauged it to be a manifestation of insecurity among those in power. In late July 1933, Klemperer saw a newsreel in which Hitler, with fists clenched and face contorted, shrieked, "On 30th January they," and here Klemperer presumed he meant the Jews, "laughed at me. That smile will be wiped off their faces." Klemperer was struck by the fact that although Hitler was trying to convey omnipotence, he appeared to be in a wild, uncontrolled rage, which paradoxically had the effect of undermining his boasts that the new Reich would last 1,000 years and that all his enemies would be annihilated. Klemperer wondered, "Do you talk with such blind rage if you are so sure of this endurance and this annihilation?" He left the theater that day with what almost amounted to a glimmer of hope. In the world outside Dodd's windows, however, the shadows steadily deepened. Another attack occurred against an American, a representative of the Woolworth dime store chain named Roland Veltz, who was assaulted in Dusseldorf on Sunday, October 8, 1933, as he and his wife strolled along one of the city's main streets. Like so many victims before them, they had committed the sin of failing to acknowledge an SA parade. An incensed stormtrooper struck Veltz twice, hard, in the face, and moved on. When Veltz tried to get a policeman to arrest the man, the officer declined. Veltz then complained to a police lieutenant standing nearby, but he also refused to act. Instead, the officer provided a brief lesson on how and when to salute. Dodd sent two notes of protest to the Foreign Office in which he demanded immediate action to arrest the attacker. He received no reply. Once again, Dodd weighed the idea of asking the State Department to announce to the world that Americans are not safe in Germany and that travelers had best not go there. But he ultimately demurred. Persecution of Jews continued in ever more subtle and wide-ranging form as the process of Gleichschaltung advanced. In September, the government established the Reich Chamber of Culture, under the control of Goebbels, to bring musicians, actors, painters, writers, reporters, and filmmakers into ideological and especially racial alignment. In early October, the government enacted the editorial law, which banned Jews from employment by newspapers and publishers, and was to take effect on January 1, 1934. No realm was too petty. The Ministry of Posts ruled that henceforth, when trying to spell a word over the telephone, a caller could no longer say D as in David, because David was a Jewish name. The caller had to use Dora. Samuel became Siegfried, and so forth. There has been nothing in social history more implacable, more heartless, and more devastating than the present policy in Germany against the Jews, Consul General Messerschmitt told Undersecretary Phillips in a long letter dated September 29, 1933. He wrote, "It is definitely the aim of the government, no matter what it may say to the outside or in Germany, to eliminate the Jews from German life." For a time, Messerschmitt had been convinced that Germany's economic crisis would unseat Hitler. No longer. He saw now that Hitler, Göring, and Goebbels were firmly in power. "They know practically nothing concerning the outside world," he wrote. They know only that in Germany they can do as they will. They feel their power within the country and are to that extent drunk with it. Messerschmitt proposed that one solution might be forcible intervention from the outside. But he warned that such an action would have to come soon. If there were intervention by other powers now, probably about half the population would still look upon it as deliverance, he wrote. If it is delayed too long, such intervention might meet a practically united Germany. One fact was certain, Messerschmitt believed. Germany now posed a real and grave threat to the world. He called it the sore spot which may disturb our peace for years to come. Dodd began to exhibit the first signs of discouragement and a deep weariness. "There is nothing here that seems to offer much promise," he wrote to his friend, Colonel Edward M. House, "and I am, between us again, not a little doubtful of the wisdom of my having intimated last spring that I might be of service in Germany. I have one volume of the Old South ready, or nearly ready, for publication. There are to be three more. I have worked 20 years on the subject, and dislike to run too great a risk of never finishing it." He closed. "Now I am here, 64 years old, and engaged 10 to 15 hours a day, getting nowhere. Yet if I resigned, that fact would complicate matters." To his friend, Jane Addams, the reformer who founded Hull House in Chicago, he wrote, "It defeats my history work, and I am far from sure I was right in my choice last June." On October 4, 1933, barely 3 months into his stay, Dodd sent Secretary Hull a letter marked "Confidential and for you alone." Citing the dampness of Berlin's autumn and winter climate, and his lack of a vacation since March, Dodd requested permission to take a lengthy leave early in the coming year, so that he could spend time on his farm and do some teaching in Chicago. He hoped to depart Berlin at the end of February and return 3 months later. He asked Hull to keep his request secret. "Please do not refer to others if you have doubts yourself." Hull granted Dodd's leave request, suggesting that at this time Washington did not share Messerschmitt's assessment of Germany as a serious and growing threat. The diaries of Undersecretary Phillips and Western European Affairs Chief Moffat make clear that the State Department's main concern about Germany remained its huge debt to American creditors. Chapter 17. Lucifer's Run. With the approach of autumn, the challenge for Martha of juggling the suitors in her life became a bit less daunting, albeit for a disturbing reason. Diels disappeared. One night in early October, Diels was working late at his office at Prince Albrechtstrasse 8, when around midnight he received a telephone call from his wife Hilde, who sounded deeply distressed. As he recounted in a later memoir, Lucifer Antiportas, Lucifer at the Gate, his wife told him that a horde of armed men in black uniforms had broken into their apartment, locked her in a bedroom, and then conducted an aggressive search, collecting diaries, letters, and various other files that Diels kept at home. Diels raced to his apartment and managed to piece together enough information to identify the intruders as a squad of SS under the command of one Captain Herbert Packebusch. Packebusch was only 31 years old, Diels wrote, but already had a harshness and callousness written deep into his face. Diels called him the very prototype and image of the later concentration camp commandants. Although the brazen nature of Packebusch's raid surprised Diels, he understood the forces at work behind it. The regime seethed with conflict and conspiracy. Diels stood primarily in Göring's camp, with Göring holding all police power in Berlin and the surrounding territory of Prussia, the largest of the German states. But Heinrich Himmler, in charge of the SS, was rapidly gaining control over secret police agencies throughout the rest of Germany. Göring and Himmler loathed each other and competed for influence. Diels acted quickly. He called a friend in charge of the Tiergarten station of the Berlin police and marshaled a force of uniformed officers armed with machine guns and hand grenades. He led them to an SS stronghold on Potsdamerstrasse and directed the men to surround the building. The SS guarding the door